When I was asked to if I'd be willing to do a session with questions and answers, really has to be a subject that I think many of you might have your own opinions and questions on. And so this particular topic comes up. I forgot this one. I put this in last night. After Michael's discussion yesterday about international convention, these are your brethren in the Bai Mari Ecclesia, where the international convention hopefully will be. And so they are some of the primary people that are hoping that you will attend and help to make the convention a blessing. So keep in mind that those are brethren that are just as diligent for the truth as we are here, and they're hoping to do be a blessing to all of you. Well, this isn't a brother. Anyone know who this is? Of course, I guess you'd have to be dead to not know who this is. As we think about it, an area where I'm sure we all have opinions and discussions, I thought looking at the Middle East and how what's changing there today might be an appropriate one for all of us to think about, because it is God's time clock. I do believe that. One of the things that's happened in all the current crisis that we've seen around the world, a financial crisis, is kind of a downplaying of what's going on in the Middle East. And I think perhaps that's the Lord's overruling, because there are some subtle changes that have been going on for a number of years. And I want to talk about a few of those and how it relates even to the financial crisis that we see today. But keep in mind that, again, the Lord is marching on, as the hymn says, and we don't always see everything clearly. And so we have to stand back on a watchtower. As Brother Russell always admonished, that the first article he always had in every issue around the view from the watchtower, and say, how do we see things shaping up? And so that's really what I want to do today. So I'll be talking for about 45 minutes on this. We'll leave the last 15 minutes for your comments, your questions, your observations. And, of course, some of the stuff you may agree or not agree with, and, of course, that's your opportunity to express your opinion. But, yes, this is Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and I've certainly, you got to say, if nothing else has happened over the last few years, you've learned how to pronounce his name. But he has said if he ever became the supreme decision maker in his country, he would sacrifice half of Iran for the sake of eliminating Israel. Now, one of the reporters talking about Ahmadinejad wrote this: he has a religious conviction that Israel's demise is essential to the restoration of Muslim glory. Now remember, Iran isn't an Arab country, it's really Persian, but yet it shares the same goals of the Muslims and identifies with that group. That the Zionist thorn in the heart of the Islamic nations, so it's not just Arab nations, but Islamic nations, must be removed. And he will pay almost any price to right the perceived historic wrong if he becomes a supreme leader and has a nuclear capability. That's a real threat. Well, I think we've just seen in the last week that he has at least perceived to be a nuclear capability. Certainly not the supreme leader at this point. The ultimate decision maker in Iran is the leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who is 70 years old, as best as we know. But interestingly enough, he has dismissed the new regime in the United States. U.S. President Barack Obama sent a New Year's greeting to the country, and he blew it off. And those were the first comments that were made to the new administration by Iran, by the senior leadership. So it looks like this, even though there's words, it's not going to be any better situation. And yet, despite President Ahmadinejad's previously mentioned ideas that, you know, I'm willing to talk, I'm willing to have talks with the U.S., the top cleric, the decision maker in Iran, has the final say in all matters of state. And it's a question whether he will or not. Interestingly enough, as we'll talk about later, it looks like we may be headed for that very issue. Now, there are two overwhelming kind of simple truths that I think are important to remember as we think about anything affecting Israel in the Middle East. And the first is, if the surrounding nations put down their arms, there'd be no more violence. Israel isn't a warmongering nation. But there's a second important truth in this, and that's if the Jewish nation put down their weapons, there'd be no more Israel. It's pretty simple, just as simple as that. So I really have no issue with Israel's defensive nature. You know, they've had to fight for their land forever, as we'll see. And I don't think it's any different until the time when the Lord brings everything to a culmination. Finally, they're unable to defend themselves. But I think it shouldn't surprise us that that's the kind of thing that has to happen. And I think because of those two simple truths, it's really, I believe, part of the plan today that they are in a much more defensive mode. You know, if we ask how big a threat really are the Jews to the world, probably the best way to put it into perspective, if you had a big room and you filled it with 453 people from across the world population cross-section of all people, how many of those people would be Jewish? I heard two. Well, it's really just one. So, you know, 453 to 1 is pretty good odds. And yet there's a disproportionate hate, I think, that comes out that there's some giant manipulation of the world by Jews. So it is an interesting idea and an interesting observation we make, and certainly an indication that the Lord is behind much of what we see going on today. Israel's embedded in the Middle East, surrounded by 23 countries that have some of the most populous areas of the world. If you look at the population of Israel compared to her neighbors, now this is based on 2008 estimates by the Central Intelligence Agency, and you can go on the Central Intelligence Agency's website and get this information. It's fairly interesting sometimes if you haven't to see the information they collect. And I believe it's more reliable than a lot of the places we look because they do try to make an effort to keep things correct. But you can see here, out of this population of 233 million people in the countries that are immediately surrounding them, here's Israel with 7 million, a little over 7 million population. And notice the square miles. Out of 2.1 million square miles, you know, they've got 8,000. And this does include what they gave away in 2005, which I believe they will eventually take back. But it does include that, which I think is part of Israel. So it's really not even about land. It's not about the people because there's not enough of them. It's not about land because there's not enough of it. I think it's simply a disdain that the surrounding nations have for Israel. And it goes back a long way. You know, if we look back in the scriptures, remember when Ishmael left, who became kind of the father of that of the Arab and some of the Bedouin nations, they went to Paran. Genesis 25:18, we can read about that. And the descendants are listed there as the Midianites, the Edomites, the Egyptians, the Assyrians. Now, in tradition, the Islamic tradition says they eventually settled in Mecca. We don't know historically if that's really true or not. But we do know in Genesis 16:12, we're told that he became kind of the leader of all the desert people. That's where those descendants came from. And remember when Moses and the people were crossing the wilderness to go to the promised land. We have the first real conflict mentioned in the 20th chapter of Numbers. Moses had brought Israel out of Egypt, and the occupants of the land were listed there, the Canaanites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Moabites, Midianites, Philistines, the Kenites, the Perizzites, and the Rephaim. And remember what Moses did. Moses sent messengers ahead. He said, look, sent them to the king of Edom, said, you know, we've got a common ancestry. We don't mean you any harm. We just want to cross the land. Well, remember how many people came out of that, out of the area of Egypt. It's estimated somewhere around at least 2 million people. I guess if you're a king, say, I'd like passage, safe passage for my 2 million people coming across here. Maybe that's why there was a little resistance. But Moses tried his best. Of course, they refused the passage. They had to battle their way, first go around and then battle their way eventually. But that whole group, they just became a perpetual nuisance to Israel. So it's nothing new. This has existed for many, many years in Israel's history. But when a modern nation was founded in 1948, that's when we really see a lot of the modern conflict. Because remember, they were off the scene in Israel for many, many years. And it's really the modern conflict began when Israel was granted the right to go back and eventually was given the land to be able to form a nation. At that time, 1948, the Arab refugees there who had settled in that land, they were told to leave by the Arab leader. Said, you know, go ahead and leave. We'll purge the land of all the Jews when they come in there, and then you can go back and settle. And about 68% of them at that point, they left. They never saw a soldier. So all the things we hear about all the expulsion of those who were in the land and the Palestinians and the group that was there, not true. You can see that about 68% left. They never even saw a soldier. But yet the Jewish refugees that were in the Arab lands at that time, we saw persecutions, we saw pogroms, we saw a lot of brutality to drive them out with this bitterness that there was a nation now being formed. So if we look at historically and estimate that the combined land holding that was lost by the Jews that were fleeing the Arab countries was about equal or greater than the area of the state of Israel. So they actually didn't gain anything. They really just kind of exchanged it and gathered in the other place. And in 1948, if we look at the number of Arab refugees that left Israel at that point, it was about 630,000 and almost matched exactly the number of Jews that left the Arab lands. So we just really exchanged populations. And it was the War of Independence then that really established the modern presence of Israel in that land. And you know, it was really, if you ever study that War of Independence, it's really amazing when you look at what was accomplished by Israel. There was a Jewish community there of about 600,000, as I said, 630,000. A lot of Holocaust survivors that came out and settled. But you think about the Israeli army today, rated by James Weekly as maybe the third or fourth most powerful army. At that time, they had 3 tanks. They didn't have any fighters. They didn't have any bombers. And they were fighting against 74 fighters and bombers by those Arab nations that came after them. And about 1% of the population was killed. Now, when you think about 600,000, 6,000 people they lost in that War of Independence, it's a pretty big number. But yet today, many are saying, you know, that was all untrue. The revisionists we have today are trying to wipe out that story of the War of Independence and how Israel fought. But they can't erase, if you read what the achievement was, when they opened that Burma Road to Jerusalem. Those Egyptian tanks that were moving from the south and the Syrian army moving in from the north, they repelled them all with hardly anything. And I think it's certainly a sign that the Lord was behind them in reestablishing them in this land that he had so diligently given them earlier. But then in August 2005, the transformational events in Israel began. Israel handed over all of Gaza that you see here, all of Gaza and all of the West Bank, part of the West Bank, you know, eventually were to hand most of it back, to the Palestinians who claimed that this was theirs, and other countries that claimed they should. You know, it's the first country in modern history to give up land that was acquired in a defensive war. And I call it a defensive war. Some would say it wasn't a defensive war. But if you look at the history, certainly in 48, 67, when they captured Jerusalem, that was more of a defensive than an offensive war. And so it was the first country that really went through this stage. So we ask the question, was Israel's abandonment of this land on Gaza and the West Bank God's will? Well, I think emphatically I would say no. Exodus 23:31-33. God told Moses, I will fix your boundary from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, and from the wilderness to the river Euphrates. And then he said, in the other part I have underlined here, you shall make no covenant with them, those that are in the land. They shall not live in your land. That land is specifically designated for Israel, for the children of Abraham. Well, of course, United Nations Human Rights Council leveled a long list of accusations of Israel for its activities in Gaza during the Operation Cast Lead. You know what, I think I missed the slide here. Hang on just a second. Operation Cast Lead, remember back in January, Hamas had this constant bombing that was going on, smuggling, they threatened the border towns of Israel, and Israel struck back in January. And their aim was to shut down those smuggling operations of all those tunnels that were coming in from Egypt, smuggling in goods, and the Israeli border towns were under constant barrage of weapons and bombing. You know, they had as little as 15 seconds after they heard a siren to take refuge. And it was it had been occurring for a number of months, number of years. Despite all of the warnings from Israel and the appeals, nothing happened. So Israel took action. And they, in Operation Cast Lead, they went after those tunnels and wiped out as many of those facilities and the capabilities of bombing that they could find. And after it was over, at least they had accomplished a short-term task of protecting their citizens. But just last month, the United Nations Human Rights Council leveled a long list of accusations at Israel for the operations it took in that Gaza Strip during Operation Cast Lead. And what they said was, in a press conference, the UN associate spokesperson said, there was a specific incident where an 11-year-old boy was used as a human shield by Israeli army soldiers. Same spokesperson says, the allegations against the terrorist group Hamas really are unverified. And the UN says an investigation is underway. UN, in many ways, unfortunately, has not fulfilled the sort of position that many hoped it would when it was created. And the UN, unfortunately, shows that same bias against Israel that was there for so many years in preventing them from going on to the Security Council. You know, Southern Command General Gallant of Israel spoke out after this was done. He said, you know, I'm proud that we have such a moral army which respects international law. He spoke of extensive preparations that they carried out and the operation of Hamas's attempts to involve civilians in the fighting. And he said, the Palestinian gunman held his arms cash in his home, came out to fight, and went back to the house, believing that we would not target them there, he said. All in all, 800 terrorists and 300 civilians that we did not want to hurt were killed in the operation. That ratio of almost a quarter uninvolved victims is an unprecedented accomplishment in the history of campaigns of this nature. They did everything they could to prevent the civilians, but it shows you the biasness that we see coming out, or those that are always against Israel. So I think it is a crossroads for Israel. In the next section, I want to show you the radical changes that have taken place in the Middle East over the last decade. And it is a time when the balance of power in the Middle East, the strategic alliances that we've seen for many, many years, are now shifted. And the question becomes, for Israel, a much broader one with this transition, is what happens next in their quest to preserve their nationhood. Psalm 83, many Bible students believe, is a description of the ongoing conflict of Israel with its neighbors and Arabs. And I think if we look at just verse 4 that I want to concentrate on there, it's an apt description of, I think, what has been going on since 1948. It says, they have said, come and let us wipe them out as a nation, that the name of Israel be remembered no more. For they have conspired together with one mind. Against you they make a covenant. And of course it goes on to describe those that are opposed to Israel. But I think certainly we'd have to see this conflict going on in this ongoing battle. And I'll come back at the end with some thoughts about what I think happens next. But it is important to understand that this, I believe, is fulfilling the prophecy of Psalm 83 and those things that have been described that would happen as one of the signs of the end times. Numbers 10:9 gives a promise to Israel that is important, I think, is applicable in our day as it was in the day it was given. It says, when you go to war in your land against the enemy who oppresses you, then you shall sound an alarm with the trumpets, and you will be remembered before the Lord your God, and you will be saved from your enemies. God intends to keep Israel in that land. It's meant for them. It was promised to Moses. It's promised to his descendants. And I think despite what the world is attempting to do, Israel is secure in its promise. Well, let's take a look at the countries around the Middle East and show how things have changed in the last few years. King Hussein of Jordan, he had ruled since 1952, shortly after the time of independence. But he died in 1999. and he was succeeded by his son, Abdullah II, who yet is to see make any significant changes in that area. As we look at the area of Lebanon, we see it now being ruled by Michael Sulaiman, and he has assumed the office in May of 2008. Now, he was the former commander of the armed forces there, and he's had a great conflict, as you know, with Syria over the years. There's always this fear that Syria will again attempt to take over Lebanon and provide a great influence there. In Morocco, which is, as you know, in the head of Egypt, just slightly out of our picture, 38 years in power, King Hassan II of Morocco. Now, he died in 1999 and was succeeded by his son, Sidi Mohammed VI. The sovereignty there is still in dispute. No one knows what happens, but Morocco could play a key role in some of the events that we see shaping the formulation of policy in the Middle East. And, of course, in Syria, as we said, bordering Lebanon, Hafez Assad ruled there for 3 decades, again, coming in soon after the War of Independence. Died in 2000, and his son Bashar took over. And of course, Bashar Assad is trying to modernize, but he's following the same kind of iron-fisted control his father did, and that's where, why Lebanon fears, and that's why some of those fears that you see come up. He's got the same kind of view as his father had, very authoritarian. And he was forced in, his hand was forced to withdraw troops from Lebanon, of course, when there was a great row about it. But he is personally implicated. He's never been absolved, and it's still an issue of the former Lebanon leader, Rafi Hariri. And his son is still on the lam, still doesn't come back because fear of his own life. Well, of course, the famous or infamous now, lately deceased Saddam Hussein. Hussein was 20 years in power. He was driven out, of course, by the 2003 invasion of the U.S., which we are still significantly involved in. And the prime minister since May of 2006 there, Nouri Kamel al-Maliki, is now trying to establish some kind of a government. And, of course, it's very difficult. As you know, it's a day-by-day situation. It appears that things have turned in Iraq. Will it be a democracy is still the question, and what will it be its attitude of the Middle East towards the rest of its neighbors if it does establish such a democracy? Now, one of the interesting things that I'd like you to consider is the issue we've had a lot of publicity, of course, in the last few years about George Bush's personal vendetta against Saddam Hussein. And I'd like to address that for just a minute because I know many brethren and the world as well just really didn't like George Bush all that much. Isn't that a great picture of Saddam Hussein? I love that picture. It really captures the essence of, I think, who he was. But think about this, okay? In Saddam Hussein was known to be a sponsor of terror, and especially terror against Israel. He openly funded the Palestinians, made no bones about the fact that he was doing it. Every time a genocide bomber blew up something in Israel, he would pay the families of that. Over the years, it's estimated he paid some $30 to $35 million to the families of the genocide bombers who blew things up. Now, he channeled all that through the Arab Liberation Front, which was in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The difficulty we have is that still exists. Now, interesting, his last payment, the last payment he made was in April of 2003. That was just 2 months before the U.S. assaulted. Now, he was the only real Arab leader, that sided morally and financially with the Palestinians. So, one of the issues, consider, if you look where Iraq was, of course, really on that border, to invade and come in attacking that eastern border of Israel. Israel strategic planners feared that Jordan, as you see there in the dark, would be attacked and swallowed up by Iraq. And that would allow the Palestinians to really join up, or allow them to join up with the Palestinians and really attack Israel on its whole eastern front. Now there's a peace treaty with Jordan that Hussein is gone, and at least from the time being, at least relieves that Eastern Front threat. So personally, I think the Lord put it in George Bush's mind to do this action and remove Hussein from power. I think it was part of the plan to protect his people, Israel. I suspect maybe there'll be some opinions on that in our question and answer period. Well, then of course, Yasser Arafat. 4 decades he led the Palestinian movement. Of course, he died in 2004, and now the Fatah party that he was part of surrendered their power in the elections, and today it's, is it Fatah or Hamas that's going to be the next ruling power of the Palestinians? Certainly an open question, and certainly one that's very difficult at this point to answer. And then Saudi Arabia. Of course, they're probably the biggest presence in the area. King Fahd of Saudi Arabia died in 2005 after 23 years. Again, notice the length of time so many of these rulers were there, soon after that war of independence of Israel, and established a pretty much of a beachhead and really had a conflict that never really resulted in a lot of difficulty. But again, the uncertainty of the future is there. His half-brother, Abdullah Aziz, became the king. You know, if you go to Saudi Arabia, see, it's one of the most open countries in the Middle East. You think we have a lot of television and satellite here. It's really the highest satellite television consumption of anywhere in the world. And the highest cell phone use, the highest internet usage. It's one of the most open as far as the money that's flowing in and the people getting it and using it. But it's also one of the most closed societies in the world when it comes to the government. And there's a creation of a tremendous social instability in that country today that we don't know what happens. You know, really, despite all the evidence that most of the terrorist organizations have at least come out of or been based in Saudi Arabia, there's never been any real accusations because of the importance that country plays with the Western world specifically in providing not only bases for their military actions, but also the other exports. The royal family there was one of the most cohesive families that we had in the whole Middle East. King Fahd, who had ruled, was one of those billionaires that was always on the Forbes list, $22 billion, slightly less than that now, but he's still pretty well off. But the problem you had there is just this huge unemployment. You know, there's no limits on population growth as we have in places like China and places there. So you have this huge unemployment because you just can't put all those people to work. There's not that much industry. And then we come to Israel. Ariel Sharon, that ruled for some time. Of course, he was the last leader to have helped in establishing the Jewish state. So he was really the last leader of the Middle East that was defined by the original Israeli-Arab conflict. Of course, in 2006, he suffered a stroke. And he was replaced by Ehud Olmert, who was, you have to say, very disappointing in terms of his attitude of doing everything he could to bring peace and give up the land for peace, anything. And, you know, it's very difficult. We can sit here and talk about it, but if you're in that situation, perhaps you do more than necessary because you get tired of that fighting. But he was replaced in February of 2009 by Netanyahu. And just 2 weeks ago, Netanyahu formed his cabinet, was successful at establishing his new government. And, you know, Netanyahu, who was there before as prime minister, now has called these U.S.-backed peace talks, proposing a two-state solution as a waste of time. And at the same time, he's refused to commit to this two-state solution. Other Israelis have. Of course, Lieberman, currently there, has said that he's not going to budge when it comes to that two-state solution. In fact, he said, you know, don't keep us on a stopwatch. And, of course, now George Mitchell, who's our envoy to the Middle East, says, well, I don't like what Lieberman says, and we're not abiding by that. So I think the rise, again, it's too soon to say what happens with the new administration in the U.S. Will they be favorable to Israel, or will they press hard on what was early established? And I think part of the downfall of George Bush was the proposed two-state solution and the roadmap which certainly wasn't indicated as part of the Lord's will. So the question is, will now these new authoritarian governments that we have, the changes that we've seen in the Middle East, will it bring fewer outside problems, or does it mean more tension? I think probably the latter is true. An example is Hosni Mubarak of Egypt. He ruled since 1981. He was one of those long-time rulers. In 2007, he finally said, okay, we'll allow open elections. Before, there was never any of this. He said, I'll allow people to run against me. Well, somehow he won by a landslide. Isn't that a surprise? His opponents were harassed. The supporters were dispersed. Some of those that wanted to run against him weren't even allowed to do that. But 20% of that parliament is now the Muslim Brotherhood. And, of course, he had a great conflict. Netanyahu's minister Lieberman, who is fast becoming a very notable person, had a remark last year that Mubarak was invited to visit Israel, and he said he didn't care to go. And, of course, he told him where he could go. But, you know, the difficulty we have is something happened in the last few years that has changed the profile about Israel. Israel's reputation as the ability to withstand that its own damage in this 35-day war in Lebanon with Hezbollah, it kind of lost that aura of invincibility in the Middle East. First time in 60-year history that we looked at that they failed to defeat an Arab army that was coming against them. And they earned this reputation, a worldwide reproach for bombing against Lebanon, the civilians, the same thing we see in Operation Cast Lead, and didn't achieve any of its goals. So there was perception that now maybe Israel is vulnerable. And of course that brings us roundabout back to Ahmadinejad. Jane's Defense Weekly says that Syria and Iran have signed an accord to help each other to resist the pressure that they're getting not to develop nuclear weapons. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, however, you know, he's declared a day now to celebrate their nuclear capability, to try to engulf it into the population. But remember his ultimate goal. He wants to finish what Hitler started and wipe the Jewish people off the map. And you know, without the U.S. presence there, the Iranian army would be the strongest regional military force. I think they may be very close to a nuclear weapon big enough to be a viable threat. And of course, we know Ahmadinejad is very eager to assert his power on both the Middle East and the rest of the world. And as I said, just last week, he established a day for celebrating their nuclear power capabilities. How's that for a stick in your eye? Take that, world. So it is an issue, I think, as we go forward. And certainly, there's a perception of Israel's weakness. If we look at those that are the real threats, you know, we have the threat of Al-Qaeda, and that's been a big one, but these are, outside of Al-Qaeda, there's a lot of groups, like the Fatah, the Hamas, Hezbollah, ones we read about. But these are all the known terrorist organizations we have, and where they started, who's really behind them. But there's one thing in common. If we look at all these organizations, what's that one thing that they all have in common? The destruction of Israel. Now, they'll come against us and any of Israel's supporters, but that's their common goal. Let's get rid of this nagging presence in the Middle East. Well, one of the promises that God has given to Israel in Ezekiel 36, 24 to 28, he says, I will take you from the nations, gather you from all the lands, and bring you into your own land. Then I will sprinkle clean water on you. Moreover, I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. That's a promise he gives them. Certainly he's brought them to the land. He's sprinkling the clean water on them, but as of yet, that new spirit that he talks about is where we look for the future. Let's just review for a moment the situation that's led us up to today and why the Jews are so hated, even in the modern world, and what's happened as a result of some of the financial crisis. You know, when Constantine became the first Christian Roman Empire, 306 AD, he declared at that point, Christianity is now the official religion of the empire. 321 AD, Previously, the Jews had the same religious rights as Christians. Now, Rome had a policy that anyone that was there in their land before they came into it, they were accepted. And the only legal church besides what Rome established in Rome itself were the synagogues of the Jews. No one else could practice religion. So even the early Christians met in the synagogues in Rome because that's where they were safe. Well, after he declared that, the persecutions begin. The council in Elvira, Spain in 305 AD said, Christians now can't share meals with the Jews. Christians can't marry Jews. Christians can't observe the Jewish Sabbath. The Edict of Milan was issued in 313 AD, and that outlawed all Jewish synagogues. And finally, then in 321, the same time when Constantine declares in persona non grata, all the businesses ceased to operate on Sunday. You know, that's how we got the idea that businesses are closed on Sunday. It goes all the way back to 321 AD. And they substituted at that point Sunday for Saturday in Christian worship. Prior to that, there's pretty good evidence that they celebrated on the Sabbath the same day. 4 years later, then Sunday was declared an official day of rest. And anti-Semitism began to grow very rapidly in the church. All the privileges that had previously been given to the Jews were withdrawn. There was no more rabbinical jurisdiction. In other words, they couldn't rule over their own people. That was abolished. Any proselytism that was tried by Jewish people was prohibited, and it was even punishable by death. The Jews were excluded from any high office, could not be involved in that office or the military. And the writings of church leaders we see at that point changed to a very aggressive anti-Jewish kind of policy. For example, Eusebius, who was the bishop of Vercelli in 370 AD, writes, the promises of the Hebrew scriptures are now transferred to the Christians. The church was a continuation of the Old Testament, and it superseded Judaism. That's when the idea of replacement theology first started to develop. That the church was now the true Israel, or Israel according to the Spirit, and that God had cast away the Jews and transferred all his love to Christians. And one of the famous writers, in fact, I've heard many quote from John Chrysostom, who was the bishop of Antioch in 387, he gave a series of sermons, 8 sermons against the Jews. And in one of them, a notable comment was made. He said, the synagogue is not only a brothel and a theater. It is also a den of robbers and a lodging for wild beasts. No Jew adores God. Jews are inveterate murderers possessed by the devil. Their debauchery and drunkenness gives them the manner of a pig. Jews are abandoned by God, and for the crime of deicide, there is no expiation possible. Remember, deicide is from the Latin for God killer. And it's the first time we see this idea used as Christ killers. Remember Matthew 27:25, those who were calling on for Jesus to be crucified answered the claim of Pilate and said, his blood be upon us and our children. And Chrysostom used that as the idea that they killed Christ and they're no longer to be tolerated in any sense. But you know, you can't have a collective responsibility for all generations. Even those who are crying out for Jesus to be crucified. You know, if it's collective, then let's sacrifice all of them. Let's hate Italians as much as we do Jews for the killing of Jesus. Now remember, Jesus says in John, I willingly give myself. So the answer, who killed Jesus? He gave himself to be killed. But what happened after that? The Jews became what's known in Latin as the servi camerae, the serfs of the chamber. What did that mean? It meant that the slave librarians, they became slaves to maintain the Hebrew writings. And they were utilized then for money lending. Why? There was a growing economy coming out of Rome and all those nations at the time, and they had to have someone who would mind the money. And usury, of course, under that law was considered endangering to Christian salvation. They couldn't charge interest. So who did they say could? well, let's have the Jews lend the money, because they're lost anyways. So what was the result? The Western countries then eventually, they became the trade agents in commerce for that same reason. And that's why you see today so many Jewish people involved in banking and commerce, so many on Wall Street. And that's why we see today an outrageous hatred that we see now promulgating against who spurred this financial crisis. Well, let's go after the Jews. They're the ones that did it. Nobody looks at the fact that Bernie Madoff and his scheme, most of all of his clients were Jewish. But again, we're seeing that promulgated. And just last week, there was an article in the New York Times identifying some of this that's going on that we see now, where people are starting to blame Jewish people and those Jewish bankers for the financial crisis, saying they're all behind it. And you do see that in times of difficulty, people are looking for a scapegoat. Well, what does this mean? I think eventually it could mean what we've expected to see is a large migration coming from the West of those in Israel, making Aliyah, and I'll mention more of that in just a minute. But let's look at Amos 9, 14 and 15. Amos 9, 14 and 15, God again promised that, he said, I will restore the captivity of my people. And when he said they would go to the land, he says, they will not again be rooted out from their land, which I have given them. In Isaiah 11 and 11 and 12, God's covenant people, Israel, would return. And notice what he says. This is not talking about the recovery from Babylon, because he says, on that day, the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand, the remnant of his people, and gather them from all over the world, and gather them from the four corners of the earth. Well, in 2006, Israel reached a milestone. What was that milestone? Since the Holocaust, there's been only two main centers of Jewish life, America and Israel. In 1990, the Jewish population in Israel was 5.5 million. In 2000, it was 5.2 million. I'm sorry, in the U.S., Jewish population was 5.5 million. In 2000, it was only 5.2 million. Israel's Jewish population passed 5.6 million in the first quarter of 2006. Brethren, that's the first time since 135 A.D. that we've seen more Jews in Israel than in any other country in the world. Now I think the last place that we haven't seen them migrate from is the Western nations. And I think this financial crisis could bring about a great aliyah as persecutions and opportunities dry up for those who are hated because of it. So I do think that there will be a war before the time of trouble that may settle the issue of what we see promulgating in the Middle East. I recognize that there's some question on this scripture, whether it applies into the kingdom or whether it applies before the kingdom. Isaiah 11, 14, they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. They shall spoil them of the east together. They shall lay their hand upon Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon shall obey them. I think personally the context suggests that it may be before the time of trouble, realizing that there's some question on this. But I think there is a promise in Jeremiah 31 that is very precious and one we should keep in mind especially. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. That's spoken by God. It's not based on the promises of man, but on the promises of God. So as we remember the Jewish people and those who are desiring to eradicate them from the earth, let's never forget that God has promised a land for them, he's promised a life for them, and he's promised a new covenant that would lead them into the kingdom. Let's close with Psalm 122, 6-9. The admonition to us, I think, at this particular point in how we look at this. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. They shall prosper that love thee. Peace be within thy walls, prosperity within thy palaces. For my brethren and companions' sakes, I will now say peace be within thee. Because of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek thy good. Brethren, let us pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Amen. Okay, we're going to go to your observations, your questions. We'll take the last 15 minutes to do that. I think Brother Dan has a mic. Maybe we can get these other lights up. Tim will get those. And, you know, you don't have to have a question if you have an observation or if this has stirred something in your mind or if you have a particular viewpoint on something that's perhaps a little different. I don't profess to have those answers, but I welcome your opinions in your discussion. So, anyone have an observation question? Chuck.
I wrote this out so I get it out right. Thank you for comments. I think your material is very good. In any case, during the Holocaust, nearly all Christians, including Bible students, were silent in the face of the genocide happening to the Jewish people. Today, we seldom talk about Shoah and what that represents. In the present-day troubles rising, anti-Semitism and attacks on Israel and Jewish people all over the world, what can we specifically do to support the Jewish community openly and to support Israel?
Okay, good question. I'll give you my opinion, and then I welcome others that may have a comment on that. I think there are some today that are doing that. There's a work going on that's trying to proclaim the rights of Israel. The difficulty we have today is the alignment that is perhaps most associated with the evangelical world of Christianity, who seem to be the most open supporters and most vocal supporters. And I think one of the challenges you have is how do you segregate yourself from those who are evangelicals. In some ways, they sound a good trumpet, but in other ways, we know that their ultimate goal is just to know that Israel is going to eventually be converted and 144,000 Jews become part of the church and the rest of them are gone. I think it is it does warn us to speak out personally whenever we get the chance on this, and I think to the extent we can support those who have a work going on to promulgate a message that Israel is favored of God in their land, they are there as part of God's promises, I think that's really what we need to do. And I've seen, you know, there's some within the Bible student movement that are doing that. I personally tried to support that. I think others feel differently. So I think the problem we have is we don't have a cohesive movement the way we did in the days of Pastor Russell when he could speak out and there was a unified voice. But I think personally, I certainly, on my own, express my concern and my support for the nation of Israel and for Zionism and the right of Israel to own that land. And I think, you know, in some degrees we will suffer as a result of that because not everyone favors that. Beyond that, to the extent perhaps we can achieve publicity, I've at times put ads in my local paper that have talked about what I believe to be the rights of Israel, to sustain editorials being written in papers. I think there's a lot of vehicles that we could use to do that. Unfortunately, I think there's not a huge organization, there's people working individually, and I think somehow perhaps a cohesiveness. But I think certainly there's a message that we can't lose, and that's our support of Israel. I'll open it up if anyone else has comments, what you think that we should have and what we should do at this point. Tim?
2 years ago, when Brother Ken Rossin was at our convention, we followed up with a showing of his presentation on Israel and prophecy. And Rhoda, how many do we have? It was over 200, wasn't it? I think it was over 200 on a Tuesday night. Oh, 151, okay. But we had a good turnout, and it was well received. Now, before the showing, one person objected to the ad, which was in the paper, and there was a little bit of flack before the showing, but at the showing, 100%, I didn't hear any negative comments, maybe somebody else did. I'm praying for the peace of Jerusalem. Can you elaborate on that? I mean, I agree, but what if people don't pray for the peace of Jerusalem? That's fine, it's going to come to pass anyway. But can you, you know, in the practical applications like in Tom's study and we didn't get to the Israel part. maybe elaborate on that. And also, I've talked to different ones who feel sorry for the Arabs. And, you know, they think that the Israelis are brutal and not insensitive and that sort of thing. Maybe you can comment on that.
I'll comment on it because it does relate somewhat to Chuck's question as well. I think there is an opportunity we have to dispel some of the incorrect news that comes out of Jerusalem. We know that news is biased, and one of the things we know in today's environment, publicity is more important than truth. And so getting something out there, everyone will believe it. Oh, I can't be wrong. I saw it on CNN. I saw it on the Internet. I think be very selective in where you get your information about what's going on in Israel. There are a few places that try to preserve the news, honestreporting.com, some of those websites that people have that are dedicated to making sure that correct news gets out around Israel. And I think that's one of the big things we can do personally to sort of dispel the myths and the misinformation that's coming out, because I think what the problem you've got is the press today is very liberal-oriented. And a liberal orientation means they're going to favor a two-state solution. They're going to favor, Arabs over Israel and the Palestinians. And I think that's a scenario where we can speak out and try to dispel the myths and the information that's coming out and try to correct that to the extent possible. And I think that's part of praying for the peace of Jerusalem. It's an awareness that we have that one of our duties is to remember that God's earthly people is the nation of Israel. The church is not a substitute people. It's an additional people. And once the church is complete, God establishes his kingdom through that nation. And I think that's an important part, that Abrahamic promise that was given, that I think that's a mental state that we should be in when it says pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Anyone else a comment, Nanette?
I have two questions on your presentation, which I enjoyed. When you said that the years just before the 48 war, there were about 630,000 Arabs that voluntarily left Palestine, and a similar number of Jews were forced out of Arab countries. I like that fact. Where can I get confirmation of that fact? In other words, if I were to cite it to someone and they wanted to know, where would I send them other than you? And of course, that isn't going to work.
I don't have
one question.
One of the places you can get is certainly on if you go to some of the Israeli governmental information, you'll get it there. And I realize some people will say, well, that's Israel saying that. There is some historical stuff that has been put together by different Christian organizations. Let me get back to you on that because I don't have the reference built into this, but I do have the reference at home where this information comes from. But it's not like a unknown, it's just unplayed and not talked about a lot. There's very little given to the idea that prior to that 1948 period when we had the UN partition that came and said Israel can go back and establish a nation, that's when we had the surrounding Arab nations start driving them out, and then they said, told all the those that were in Israel, well, you come out voluntarily, and we're going to take care of them as soon as they come in, and you'll go back. And kind of that's the part that was downplayed when, unfortunately, when Arafat was in place. But there is some historical, if you look at the numbers of people that were driven out in some of the Jewish pogroms, that's where those numbers come from. But I'll have to get back to you on that specific accumulation of data.
And my second question relates to the statistics you gave of the Arab terrorist organizations that Hussein was supporting. I've never heard that before, and I'm surprised that Bush's administration did not use that as a reason for going to war instead of the falsified reasons they did use.
Yeah, well, again, it's one of those things, it's what gets reported is not always the facts. But I didn't say that he supported all those terrorist organizations. His main support was against the Palestinians and the genocide bombers and the Hezbollah group. That's where he was funding that. The rest of those terrorist organizations on that chart And if anybody wants this, I can give you a copy. Those charts designate where those places are originated and who's supporting them. But he was really supporting the Hezbollah bombers and the genocide bombers only, and that's where he was funding that. But again, you know, unfortunately, there was a lot of information given out in the early war of Iraq that was just really not subscribed to, because everyone felt that George Bush had an agenda to avenge his father, you know, with Saddam Hussein. And again, it's one of these cases where we don't get the facts reported accurately over the mass news media. And that's a challenge that we have, is how do you get accurate information? I got to go back. David Rice had his hand up. Oh, somebody up there had it. Oh, okay, he's deferring to you, Michael.
We understand that a one-state solution would be suicide for Israel, because the Arabs multiply so fast that if, in fact, the West Bank and Gaza were incorporated into the land and there was a one-state solution, that would be the end of Israel in a very short time.
Right.
At the same time, although there may be 5.6 million Jews, there are a lot of Arabs that are living in the West Bank and in Gaza. Therefore, if Netanyahu was to invite you to come over as an advisor, what advice would you give him as far as the millions of Arabs that are sitting there? Are you, in fact, saying export them to the Arab lands and let them, in fact, decide where they sit and take back the land that God has given you? Or just what advice would you give him?
Fair question. No one can ever accuse Michael of not being direct. That's what I love about him and love working with him. You know, in my mind, I think where the solution will come, and I think eventually, and it's based on some investigation, scriptures, whatever, I think eventually that group just becomes absorbed in Israel. I don't say that they drive them out, but they don't have a separate area. If you really interview the Palestinians, about 60% of them are not necessarily in favor of a two-state solution. They're very inclined to accept the host Israel and the provisions that they provide them. Are much better than what they get out of the Palestinian government. So I think what I would say, work on a plan that doesn't give them a separate land, integrates them into Israeli society. Now, I think personally, eventually, they may exit, but I think many of them would be willing to reside there and live under the rules and regulations of Israel. I think the biggest issue that I have is creating a separate state there. No problem with the population. I don't think Israel ever becomes, prior to the kingdom, totally just Jewish. I think there will always be some residue of Christian and perhaps even Muslim. But if there were a war against the Arabs, I think there would certainly be a fleeing from many of those who would either side with their host Israel or they'd leave and go. Now, there are some I've heard that believe that eventually, if Israel takes Jordan, which I think is a possibility, that could be a place where they could reside. So that's the only thing I would advise Netanyahu. And I'm sure he's not going to ask me, but if he does, I would say, you know, I would support his claim not to create a two-state solution, that is not the solution, that land belongs to Israel. You know, it's not, they have no desire to be cruel to that population, but it's just integrate them and say, if you're willing to live by these rules, we are glad to have you as part of our country. So, all right, one last question, Brother David.
Sometimes we go back to the description of the land of Israel that Moses was given, and that includes Gilead, the East Bank, and includes some up north all the way to Euphrates. How is it supposed that all that land would ultimately be part of the land of Israel again? But recently, as we're studying in class Ezekiel, we saw that in the last chapters of Ezekiel, the land was restricted only to the west part of Jordan. Do you have a comment on that, or does that impact our expectations at all?
Yeah, I understand that, because it's the idea whether or not they would get east of Jordan and get part of that land. I do know that Ezekiel, and I don't have a strong argument one way or the other on that one, David, but I do think some of the land, I'll just put it in the broader context, I do not see that Israel gets all that land back prior to the time of the kingdom. I think some of that, if we look at when all that land was ruled peacefully, it was in Solomon's kingdom, and that was a kingdom of peace, basically. And I think that's maybe when the full restoration of the land of Israel comes. Now, I know George has had several talks that I've enjoyed on the land that Israel would have, and I think he's got some very good ideas there. But personally, I think some of that land may not be theirs until we go into the kingdom and finally that's resolved, and as more come back, I think there will be a last kind of aliyah coming, either at the end or after this is, after the time of what I consider to be Jacob's trouble, that all that land does not come back until that point.
Okay.